The case of the day is United States against Cross. And we will devote this argument to discussing how many legal scholars are on this panel. Mr. Eisenberg.
May it please the court, I'm Mark Eisenberg. I represent Altuan Cross in this matter. The main issue in this case is that the court, in our opinion, miscalculated the guidelines, and I'll talk about that in a minute. I do want to talk about the second issue in my brief, the ex post facto issue, briefly.
You better talk about Jameson quickly, too.
Well, I was going to talk about how I believe Judge Easterbrook has indicated that the ex post facto clause probably doesn't apply anymore after Booker. What I want to talk about there is the reasoning in those cases seems to me to be really inaccurate. The argument that because this was a judicial determination that these now guidelines are advisory, the ex post facto clause doesn't apply because the defendant had notice of the maximum penalty before Booker, he had notice of the maximum penalty after Booker, and therefore ex post facto doesn't apply. But then I looked at the guideline, 1.B.11. So when the guidelines changed by the commission, even though the maximum notice is the same, the notice of the maximum penalty is the same. The guidelines clearly says
you can allocate your argument time as you wish, but I think the probability that we will be overruling Jameson in the foreseeable future is negligible. It's not as if there were a conflict among the circuits and we were a lone holdout.
I appreciate that.
This is a position that's been made nationwide. It's lost nationwide. Let's get on with life.
Okay. I just wanted to say I didn't see the difference between having notice before Booker and having notice after Booker, and I didn't see the difference how ex post facto would be applied differently because really it's the same argument. He had notice. But with that, I will move along. The real issue is that we believe the judge miscalculated the guidelines based on unreliable evidence. And that all boils down to her view of Jerry McCoy. When the district court makes a mistake in the calculations under the guidelines, its judgment about a reasonable sentence is presumably affected by that error. So that's the issue. And I realize that the judges are the sole credibility of the fact-finding of the witnesses, but they must base their decision on information that has a sufficient indicia of reliability.
Now, counsel, this indicia of reliability stuff is criteria for the use of hearsay. But there was no hearsay used here, was there?
Well,
this guy was on the stand. McCoy testified. He was subject to cross-examination. I mean, why should we be using the criteria for hearsay testimony to evaluate the way the district court responded to live testimony?
I got that from the Roach case, U.S. versus Roach, and I only had the Westlaw site, but it's Seventh Circuit from 2005. We can go on to the credibility issue if you don't want to look at my reliability issue. The commentary to Guideline 6A1.3, Parent A, and I guess this is more what you're talking about, Judge, is that in some cases it says, the commentary says, in some cases an evidentiary hearing may be the only reliable way to resolve disputed issues. And that's certainly true here.
And one was held.
No doubt about it. And Mr. McCoy testified, and his testimony was totally incredible. The pre-sentence writer...
The district judge believed it.
I'll tell you what, if everybody else was in the room... Well, no, the district court didn't believe it. Let me get to that point in a second. It's so easy, when you're not there, for me to say, if you had been there, you wouldn't have believed it. But I know you weren't there, so anyway, his testimony was totally...
He just assessed whether, when the district court made a credibility finding, it was clearly erroneous.
Well, and...
And that's almost impossible to do, the Supreme Court said in Anderson against Bessemer City.
Well, I realize that great deferences are given to the court's determination of credibility, in including the amount of drug quantity. But the court's deference isn't unlimited. That's United States versus Noble from this circuit back in 2001. The pre-sentence writer concluded at the she had Mr. McCoy's debriefing is in the appendix at page 8, A8 in my brief. She had that before she wrote the pre-sentence. And she concluded that there was no corroboration and that Mr. Cross's guidelines were between 70 and 87 months. Then the government submitted these phone records. These phone records that supposedly corroborated what Mr. McCoy was saying. And the pre-sentence writer wrote an addendum, and she said, the phone calls tend to corroborate, so if the court determines Mr. McCoy's statements are credible, additional cocaine should be added to the total weight. And I understand what you're saying about it's the court's determination or to determine the credibility of the witness. But, Your Honor, I submit, if you look at this and you read that transcript, there is no way that anybody could determine he's credible. First of all, he refused to answer half my questions on cross-examination. He didn't answer the number of times he bought half kilos. He didn't answer whether he used cocaine during this time. He didn't answer if he purchased cocaine from his brother. He didn't answer whether he had committed a fraud on the United States when he was trying to get his friend to file false financial statements to buy his house, which was in a process of being forfeited for this drug case. And be that as it may, then he said he got 27 years from Judge Shabazz, but he only sold 200 to 300 grams of cocaine. And I said, that's all you sold. That is all I sold. And by the way, if that was in the case and he had been a criminal history 6, his guidelines would have been 51 to 63 months. Instead, he got 27 years. So I don't know how you could possibly say this fellow was credible. Then he also said, well, he never lied to the IRS. His tax returns were included in the exhibits at the sentencing. The most he ever made during a three-year period that they were submitted for was $14,000, yet he was able to buy a $389,000 house. And the court, when it looked at this, when it was done with the testimony and it was examining the evidence, it said, she realized that he had credibility problems, but she downplayed it. She said, I certainly agree that Mr. McCoy has some credibility problems. If the decision turns solely on his credibility, I would agree with you. But that's what it did turn on, because the rest of it has to do with speculation and innuendo. She said, well, Mr. Cross sold cocaine for 9 years, yet he only had one cocaine possession charge from 1995. Then she said, well, he had so many lenient and reduced sentences from state court that his criminal history isn't adequately affected. Well, how would she know that? She didn't look at all the facts of every one of his criminal charges that were included in the pre-sentence. I represented him on all of them anyway. She had no idea what those charges were. So for her to make that statement to me is speculation and innuendo. And then we go back to Jerry McCoy, the liar, the guy that wouldn't answer half my questions. And what she says is, even though she says he has no credibility, or she questions his credibility, when it comes time to determining the sentence on page 56 of the transcript, she adds up exactly what he says and determines, therefore, he had between 5 and 15 kilos instead of the 1.3 kilos that he got caught with. It doubled his sentence from 70 to 87 months to 150 months and slammed him. And that's just wrong. The guy had no credibility. I don't care what you say about a judge being able to judge it. She says herself, no credibility, but I'm going to follow what he says anyway. Now the government's going to get up and say, all these phone records corroborated everything. The phone records didn't do anything other than show that Mr. Cross and Mr. Prado Morales, the source of all these drugs, had telephone contact 46 times between September 2nd and October 19th. So what? So they were friends. So maybe they were drug dealers. I'm not insulting your intelligence by saying this is all that he got caught with is all he did. But the point is, you can't get from 1.3 kilos to 5 to 15 kilos on speculation and innuendo unless you determine that Jerry McCoy is telling the truth, and you can't do that in this case. So then we get back to, I don't know if Judge Easterbrook said this or Judge Posner said of this, about the person who asked to get resentenced takes the risk because the guidelines are advisory now.
It doesn't really matter who writes opinions for this court.
I understand that. You said that earlier today. I thought it was you, but I'm not sure. But in any event, I guess what I'm asking is, this sentence was unreasonable based on the guidelines calculations, and because of that, I think you should remand it. I think you should have her recalculate the guidelines, saying that no reasonable person could possibly determine that Mr. McCoy's credibility was truthful, and remand and have him sentenced according with the guidelines in the right calculation. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Jarosz.
May it please the court. The government asks this court to affirm the conviction because the defendant's real arguments are, one, that the guidelines were calculated incorrectly, and then the second argument is one that says, geez, the court should have applied or shouldn't have applied the discretionary sentence because that was in violation of the ex post facto clause. In terms of the guidelines being calculated incorrectly, the question really comes to whether or not the court committed clear error in relying on Mr. McCoy's testimony. In that regard, it seems almost and virtually it is impossible to say that that isn't the case, because you couldn't imagine a more sort of typical example of what happens. The court needs to hear real live testimony, so what do they get? They get real live testimony. The defendant has the right to cross-examine Mr. McCoy, which he does so vigorously, going forward and asking him all the questions that he needed to ask him. He makes much ado about the fact that Mr. McCoy wouldn't answer certain questions, and yet nothing was done about that. When you look at the transcript, there's really no reason why Mr. McCoy didn't answer. He didn't claim the fifth.
How do you respond to the argument that the cell phone records show no calls between McCoy and the supplier during the bulk of the time period in which, you know, the drug dealing allegedly occurred?
Your Honor, all the record shows is that there's two things. And what Mr. Eisenberg's complaint is not that Mr. McCoy's phone doesn't show calls between Mr. McCoy and the drug dealer. It's that there's no evidence of his client calling the source of the cocaine, Mr. Morales, during the time period. And the answer is that those records weren't before the court. Nobody had subpoenaed them or obtained them. The real import of those records is to show, as highlighted by the court, as Mr. Eisenberg pointed out on page 54 through 56, all the factors she considered in corroborating Mr. McCoy. What she used those phone records for was to show just simply the association in fact of the number of calls. As the court's aware, there were 650 calls between Mr. McCoy and the defendant, Mr. Cross, between February and September. And then there were 47 calls between Mr. Morales, the source of the cocaine, and Mr. Cross between September and October 18th, September 2nd and October 18th. In those circumstances, Your Honor, what the court's using is using it as corroboration to show one of many factors why Mr. McCoy can be believed that, in fact, they were dealing with Mr. Morales as the source of the cocaine. Your Honor, the case itself, in terms of the ex post facto clause, is squarely on point. It's been rejected by this court, and really there's no reason to overturn Jameson. The defendant doesn't make that argument that somehow it should be overturned at this point, and we would ask the court to affirm both the judgment and conviction and sentence in this case. Unless the court has any other questions of me, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Eisenberg? Well, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment and your assistance both to your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement. The court will be in recess until tomorrow.